Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. A war of words in the growing crisis on North Korea, with Donald Trump threatening to meet North Korea with fire and fury, the likes of which this world has never seen before, and North Korea responding to Trump's comment, basically saying he is unreasonable, you can't reason with him, and he only responds to power, and that they are planning an airstrike on the U.S. territory of Guam. This after the United Nations Security Council hit North Korea with steep economic sanctions. China, South Korea, and other powers are caught in the mix. Our guest is historian Dr. Gerald Horn. And an update on Venezuela. We speak to human rights attorney and member of the National Lawyers Guild Task Force on the Americas. And for our weekly Earth Watch, we are joined by Pablo Salon, director of the Fundación Salón and former Bolivian ambassador to the United Nations. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. North Korea has announced a detailed plan to launch a salvo of missiles toward the U.S. Pacific territory of Guam, a major military hub and home to U.S. bombers. North Korean state media said the plan could be sent to leader Kim Jong-un for approval within a week or so.
The North Korean army will complete its plan to hit Guam before mid-August, reporting it to our nation's nuclear forces commander-in-chief, and will stay ready for his order of proceed.
North Korea's official news agency described Trump's warning that the North would face fire and fury as a load of nonsense. The statement continued, quote, "Sound dialogue is not possible with such a guy bereft of reason, and only absolute force can work on him." If the North carried out such a launch in waters off Guam, it would mark the most provocative missile launch to date. Japan and South Korea quickly vowed a strong reaction. Pentagon Papers whistleblower and anti-nuclear activist Daniel Ellsberg urged the Trump administration to de-escalate the situation by halting provocative war games with South Korea.
North Korea wants us to cease these exercises. Of course we should cease these exercises off their coast. They're practicing, invading, and assassinating, and leaking deliberately from the top plans for assassinating and regime change. CIA leader Pompeo just last week talked about how good it would be to get rid of Kim Jong-un. That's why I'm sure that Kim Jong-un has made arrangements that if he is assassinated, there will be retaliation on the largest scale. There are no words strong enough to say how important it is that the president not be permitted to start a war with North Korea.
Ellsberg spoke at the annual protest at the Lawrence Livermore Nuclear Weapons Design Lab in the San Francisco Bay Area. The protest marked the 72nd anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The chair of Kenya's election commission says the country's electoral database was unsuccessfully targeted by a hacking attempt. The comments came as Kenyans tensely awaited the final tally of an election pitting incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta against challenger Raila Odinga. Odinga has charged hackers were able to manipulate the results against him following the vote. Preliminary results have given Kenyatta a comfortable lead. Former Secretary of State John Kerry is in Kenya as part of an observer team for the Carter Center. Al Jazeera asked him about the hacking allegations.
It needs to be examined. Number one, did it happen? Number two, if it did happen, did it have any impact on the returns that were being reported? Did it have an impact, finally, on the election itself? So I think that it deserves to be examined, but it is not a reason to stop the process or to question the entire election at this point.
While most of Kenya was calm today, clashes between police and protesters erupted in a Nairobi slum for a second day. Police opened fire on protesters. Yesterday, at least three people were shot and killed in confrontations between security forces and opposition supporters in several parts of the country. A study by the nonpartisan Kaiser Family Foundation says the Trump administration's own actions are triggering double-digit premium increases on individual health insurance policies purchased by many consumers. The analysis from the Kaiser Family Foundation finds that mixed signals from Donald Trump have created uncertainty far outside the norm, and that has led insurers to seek higher premium increases for 2018 than otherwise would have been the case. A federal judge threw out the effort of the Texas Attorney General to have a state ban on sanctuary cities preemptively declared constitutional. The ruling keeps alive a lawsuit by the cities of Houston and Dallas. They want a judge to block the Texas statewide ban on sanctuary cities before it can take effect on September 1st. President Trump's continued silence following the recent bombing of a mosque in a Minneapolis suburb is an outrage, according to Minnesota Democratic Representative Keith Ellison, who is also the party's deputy chair. The FBI is investigating Saturday's incident when an explosive was thrown through the window of the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington, Minnesota. No one was injured. Speaking to the Associated Press, Ellison said, "The president's failure to condemn the attack suggests his oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States, including the right to equal protection under the law, only extends to people who meet certain racial and religious criteria," Ellison said. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. This week, Donald Trump has pushed the crisis in North Korea into even more dangerous territory. His most direct provocation came on Tuesday when he said North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. And as the international community expresses alarm over his words, he doubled down on them, tweeting on Wednesday that the U.S. nuclear arsenal is now stronger and more powerful than ever before. Hopefully, we will never have to use this power, but there will never be a time that we, meaning the United States, are not the most powerful nation in the world. The context for this saber rattling is the new U.S. intelligence report that North Korea has produced, a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can fit inside missiles. This, according to a report by the Washington Post. Further context is the new UN sanctions that have been imposed on North Korea. These strict sanctions cut up a third of the country's exports, blocking all exports of coal, iron ore, lead and lead ore, and seafood, which could cost the country an estimated $1 billion a year. These new sanctions were said to be in response to North Korea's launching of two intercontinental ballistic missiles last month. The sanctions were approved unanimously by the UN Security Council, interestingly enough, including China and Russia. Meanwhile, China has also been urging both the United States and North Korea to avoid escalation. And back in the United States, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson stressing diplomacy and reassuring the U.S. that people could sleep well at night, while Defense Secretary James Mattis is going on the offensive, saying North Korea risked the end of its regime and the destruction of its people if it did not stand down. And in response to all of this, in particular to Trump, North Korea has set its sights on Guam. The North Korean military, in a statement late Wednesday, promised to finalize a plan this month to fire four mid-range missiles into the waters off Guam, which is a U.S. territory. The same statement from North Korea threatened to turn the U.S. mainland into the theater of a nuclear war. And according to Sputnik News, the Pentagon has prepared a contingency plan to launch a preemptive strike against North Korea, which may involve U.S. fighters on Guam. And a spokesman for U.S. ally South Korea has warned that the North, quote, will face a strong response from South Korea's military and the U.S. South Korea alliance if there were more any more provocations. First, before we welcome our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, waiting in the wings, let us go to a clip from BBC News and see how they're responding, how they're reporting on all of this.
War of words between the U.S. and North Korea is intensifying as Pyongyang says a plan to fire missiles over Japan to land in the sea near the U.S. territory of Guam will soon be ready. State media denounced Donald Trump's warnings of fire and fury, saying the U.S. leader was bereft of reason. The U.S. has warned North Korea's actions could mean the end of its regime. Yugita Lamai reports from Seoul.
A show of strength in Pyongyang. North Korean state television showed a mass of people marching in support of the leadership in the country, even as the government made more threats. These are details of its plan to attack Guam. Four rockets will fly over Japan and land in the Pacific Ocean near the island, it says. It's drills by U.S. bomber aircraft like these, which are stationed at Guam, that have angered Pyongyang. But while a fierce reaction from North Korea is expected, this time it's matched by aggression from the U.S. president. After saying Pyongyang will be met with fire and fury, Donald Trump boasted about America's nuclear arsenal, a message which will be perceived as another threat by North Korea. It's making people around the world nervous, and many countries have urged restraint.
Our strong wish is that the United States keeps calm and refrain from any moves that would provoke another party into actions that might be dangerous.
The border is just about 50 kilometers from here, but things on these streets are not tense. This country has dealt with threats from its neighbor for a long time now. And that's why perhaps people here are unlikely to believe just yet that this war of words will turn into something more.
All righty. And we are also going to go to a very short clip of Trump making his fire and fury comments. Now, it is being reported that these comments were off the cuff and that they weren't really checked and gone through usual protocol. And the White House was forced to issue a statement saying, well, actually, even though they were Trump's words, that the generals had some idea of the tone of Trump's remarks. Here's Donald Trump.
They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
I'd like to welcome our regular Dr. Gerald Horn, professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston. He's published more than 30 books, including Confronting Black Jacobins, the U.S., The Haitian Revolution, and The Origins of the Dominican Republic, and Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. And he's also, in his many books, written on the Asia-Pacific region. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, so Dr. Horn, you certainly have raised on our weekly roundtable, where you are regular panelists, the dangers of what is happening in the Pacific region and the kind of provocations going on, not only against North Korea, but against China. And to start off our discussion, I think it would be helpful for our audience to be reminded a little bit about that, the Korean War, that war in the Korean Peninsula that still isn't finished, really. Dr. Horn?
Well, you know that in mid-June 1950, a conflict erupted on the Korean Peninsula, and it eventually drew in the United Nations, actually the United States under United Nations flag. That war lasted from 1950 to 1953, and the tide was basically turned against the U.S.-UN forces when China crossed the border and pushed back the U.S.-UN forces. And so when you talk about today a crisis in North Korea, ultimately, you have to talk about China, not only because of that history I've just recounted, but also because North Korea and China are comrade regimes, if you like. Both are ruled by communist parties. It's interesting to note as well that the history of resistance in North Korea and China both mirror each other. Both take a very strong anti-Tokyo posture, not least because the Korean Peninsula was colonized by Japan between 1910 and 1945, and also the Chinese Communist Party gains its legitimacy because of the anti-Tokyo war that it waged from the 1930s up until the defeat of Japan in 1945. Interestingly enough, after President Harry Truman dropped atomic weapons on Japan in August 1945. Now, this crisis is also taking on an extremely explosive nature because of deteriorating relations between Beijing and Washington. There was a kind of false dawn after the Mar-a-Lago summit between President Xi Jinping and President Trump a few months ago. But that false dawn has evaporated. I point you to the Washington Post this morning, which carries a story about an imminent trade war between China and the United States, and trade wars oftentimes give rise to other kinds of war. And likewise, if you go to your local AMC theater complex, AMC, of course, is owned by a Chinese conglomerate, Darling and Wanda, you will find playing there, for example, Monterey Park, just 6 miles from Pasadena, this new Chinese blockbuster film, the biggest grossing Chinese film up to this point, called Wolf Warrior 2. Which takes place in a fictional African country and features a Euro-American villain, the likes of which you've never seen, who is leading a kind of Boko Haram terrorist type of organization in this fictional African country that slays babies, and he is ultimately defeated by a Chinese force. I understand from reports that the audience, which was mostly Asian American in Monterey Park, applauded wildly after this Euro-American villain was defeated. This is just one more symptom of this deteriorating relationship between Washington and Beijing, which is stalking and haunting this exceedingly dangerous situation on the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, and, you know, some people, I suppose, were surprised that China and Russia went along with the sanctions imposed, you know, by the UN Security Council, because it makes sense that neither China or Russia really wants any kind of war or destabilization in North Korea. So there's all the tough talk, and Trump, his rhetoric, which he thought was going to intimidate North Korea, clearly did not, given the response of North Korea. And in fact, Trump setting up a red line, because he says any more threats coming from Kim Jong-un will be, you know, met with this power and fire and fury. Well, guess what? Since he made that statement, there have been at least two further threats coming from North Korea, and it remains to be seen what Trump will do in response. But behind the scenes and all of the rhetoric, there seems to be some quiet diplomacy going on, because I'm seeing a report here that North Korea released a Canadian pastor. And this in the midst of all of this, you know, standoff. I mean, it is a Canadian pastor, but it seems to give an indication that North Korea, you know, is ready to do something to de-escalate. Dr. Horn, your view on why you think China and Russia went along with the sanctions that are going to be very, very tough on North Korea, but also will impact the Chinese economy. And, you know, just kind of the what do you think is going on here?
Well, point number one, I think that neither Beijing nor Moscow necessarily welcomes a nuclear-armed North Korea. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that if history is any guide, that China in particular will look the other way when its many firms conduct business relations with North Korea in contravention of these latest sanctions. Part of the problem on this side of the Pacific is that the State Department has been depleted. Top jobs have not been filled by Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, as he undergoes or seeks to execute a massive reorganization of the State Department. This is taking place as well in the context of bitter infighting in the White House itself between the Steve Bannon nationalists, the white supremacist wing of the White House staff, and General McMaster, the National Security Council. Breitbart News is conducting a kind of civil war against General McMaster, seeking to force him out. This means that the Trump team is not on the same page. They're all singing from different hymn books, which makes U.S. foreign policy more incoherent than it ordinarily is. Now, crossing back to the Pacific, it's clear that the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, has been trying to learn the lessons of history, one of which is that when Muammar Gaddafi in Libya turned over his nuclear stockpile or his attempt to develop a nuclear stockpile and denuded his government of nuclear weapons, that was a signal in 2011 for a NATO bombing campaign that eventually drove him out of office and led to his death. North Korea, the DPRK, feels that nuclear weapons are kind of an insurance policy. At the same time, I think if you look at U.S. strategy, the U.S. strategy is not only aimed at North Korea, it's not only aimed at China. Keep in mind that Vladivostok, Russia's window on the Pacific Ocean, is not that far distant from the DPRK. Moscow has been funneling gobs of capital into Vladivostok, and that has been supplemented by Chinese capital as well. Keep in mind as well that just south of the DPRK is South Korea, which happens to house major competitors such as Kia and Hyundai and Samsung to U.S. firms such as Apple and Ford and General Motors. And collateral damage to those South Korean firms would not necessarily be the cause of shedding of tears in the United States of America, certainly in the corporate suites. So this is a very complex scenario, but quite frankly, Washington is playing with fire. This is an ultimately dangerous situation, and the fact that Mr. Trump issued his fire and fury threat in August 2017, after in August 1945, President Truman threatened to have a rain of ruin, his words, upon Nagasaki after the bombing atomically of Hiroshima, makes this whole situation even more chilling and threatening.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the United States still provoking, or I should say further provoking China with the South China Sea Islands. I read something that I think a bomber, U.S. bomber, flew close to the, you know, right close to those islands. So, I mean, there's still some activity kind of warning China that the United States may be ready to make some military move there. But you mentioned South Korea, and of course, the demilitarized zone is still there, and the new president of South Korea, which was much more to the left than the previous prime minister of South Korea, and he had hoped that there could just be dialogue and talks with North Korea. And now it seems, in part because of the rhetoric from the United States and because of the strong sanctions from the United States, that North Korea is now saying that they are not prepared at all to have any kind of dialogue. Whether that is true or not, and whether any quiet diplomacy may already be taking place, we don't know. So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that relationship with South Korea and North Korea, because it seems now the new president of South Korea is being pushed in the direction that he didn't want to go, including accepting these THAAD missiles that initially he had said that he didn't really want them on in South Korea at all. And also the fact that there is a law in South Korea that so-named dissidents that flee North Korea to the south, but who now want to go back home, are denied. In fact, they're put in jail rather than allowing them to go back to North Korea. So you have family members that are really divided in this way. Your thoughts on this, Dr. Horn?
Well, anti-missile defense is a key and crucial component of this whole situation. The new regime in Seoul, South Korea, thus far has been backing away from the previous government's decision to install anti-nuclear or anti-missile defense. Recall that China objected strenuously when the decision was made by the previous Seoul regime to install this anti-missile defense, feeling, perhaps correctly, that anti-missile defense is really just a provocation aimed at China. Speaking of provocations aimed at China, it's not just the fact that the United States has been sailing its naval vessels into what China considers to be its territorial waters in the South China Sea, but recall that in July 2017, there were these massive naval maneuvers featuring the navies of the United States, India, and Japan, which China saw as a direct threat. This comes in the context of a standoff on the border separating China and India that's been taking place for weeks now. This takes place in the context of a sharp war that was fought in 1962 between India and China. And that war has not received as much attention that it deserves because it took place during the same time of the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis, the last time that the world came to the brink to the precipice of nuclear destruction, which apparently Mr. Trump is trying to lead us to as we speak.
Yeah, and also on Guam and why Guam? We know that Guam was occupied by the Japanese during World War II, where the indigenous population was basically terrorized and interned, actually, and guns were actually set up to massacre them. The indigenous people, and people forget that there is an indigenous population in Guam. I mean, it just didn't start with the Japanese invasion or now with the U.S. But what has happened is that Guam is now really central to U.S. military operations in the whole of the Pacific region. And it has been home to nuclear weapons, to mustard gas, and many other, you know, cancer-causing and really bad for people's health and the environment. In the 1980s, it is said the Navy discharged radioactive water into a harbor that people use for fishing and, you know, much more. So it's no accident that North Korea is threatening. And I noted they're not threatening to hit Guam. They're saying that, you know, the missiles will be fired close to Guam. And this is very different from what's the rhetoric coming from the United States. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of North Koreans have hit the streets protesting the United States. Dr. Horn, just on the centrality of Guam and the fact that so many weapons are also pointed not only at North Korea, but at China.
Well, there is considerable concern and consternation, understandably, in Guam as we speak about this alleged attempt to launch missiles close to their territorial waters. This is obviously understandable why this consternation is growing, but it seems to me to be worsened and exacerbated by a blockbuster story that's just breaking on the front page of USA Today that talks about a scandal in the Catholic Church involving child sex abuse that dwarfs any of these other scandals that have hit Australia, the United States, and other countries where the Catholic Church operates. This is happening as the Guam people begin to question even more deeply the decades of U.S. colonialism and U.S. imperialism that has been foisted upon this island. And as this drawn into the so-called missile bullseye, I dare say that this growing anti-U.S. imperialist sentiment will continue to flourish.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Dr. Horn, we're going to continue this discussion on our weekly roundtable tomorrow, where I'm sure who knows what will happen between today and tomorrow. But meanwhile, the governor of Guam and some in the United States are trying to damp down fears of people who are thinking, well, my goodness, they may be hit with a nuclear weapon at any moment. And Donald Trump seems to be oblivious to what it might mean making a strike on North Korea that could actually lead to a nuclear war. So very dangerous times indeed. Dr. Horn, thank you for joining us. To be continued tomorrow. So tune into our weekly roundtable. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are going to take a brief station break, and when we return, an update on Venezuela, and then our weekly Earth Watch. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners in the Korean Peninsula. Yes, we do have some listeners in South Korea. North Korea, we have no idea. And we would like to give them a shout out today, our listeners in South Korea. If you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. Our shows are also posted there, and also on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. All of our back shows are archived there. All righty, now we are going to turn our attention to Venezuela, an update. We've been covering Venezuela, given all of the crisis and the pressure leading up to the vote in Venezuela called by President Maduro for a constituent assembly. The vote did happen. The constituent assembly is in full swing. And despite so much pressure, protests on the streets, opposition to Maduro, they actually literally burned people alive, which some people did not hear about during those protests. And the United States and the Vatican and the Western nations put a huge amount of pressure on Venezuela. And indeed, Mercosur, which is the economic collaboration body in Latin America, they have now suspended Venezuela. Some other updates is that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has now said that a truth commission will be established to ensure that those responsible for the recent unrest are brought to justice, including on August 7th, there was an attack on a military base. Now, you might remember when we have been covering Venezuela before, those of you who are regular listeners, that the opposition was really trying to agitate to try to get the military to split and basically make a move against President Maduro's government. But that did not happen. So this was very suspect. An attack on a military base in Carabobo State on August the 7th, and two people were actually killed in that attack. There were apparently 20 attackers, 10 of whom were captured. Now, though the attackers, they dropped flyers outside, apparently, the base before their attack, and they made a video, and they were claiming to be military, it turns out the majority of those captured after the attack were, guess who? Paid civilians. Meanwhile, elections are going to be coming up. The Venezuela opposition is split. They are in disarray, even as the United States announced new sanctions on Venezuela. But interestingly enough, these sanctions will not include sanctions on oil. We know that Venezuela has the world's largest reserves of crude in the world. And apparently, several industry leaders and Republicans, there are 9 companies, including Chevron, Valero, Citgo, Phillips 66, and others that currently process Venezuela crude in more than 20 U.S. refineries, a lot of them located along the Gulf Coast, and they don't want any sanctions on oil. And an influential industry group, including these 9 companies, they've written twice now to Donald Trump warning that the United States, there's no guarantee that other key sources of U.S. heavy crude imports from Canada, Mexico, and Colombia could provide enough additional supply to replace Venezuelan oil. And this is according to Associated Press, that many refineries would likely have to turn to Saudi Arabia, but that would mean higher costs and the cost of gas will go up. Also, six congressmen from three states in Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana, they also wrote to Trump against banning Venezuelan oil imports. So there you go. But Washington did put some sanctions in place, including against the brother of Hugo Chavez, Adan Chavez. They slapped some sanctions on Nicolas Maduro himself. So what does this all mean, and are these sanctions really legal? I'd like to welcome Susan Scott. She is a California human rights attorney. She's active with the Great National Lawyers Guild. She's on its task force on the Americas, and thus she is very familiar with the situation in Venezuela. She's organized delegations and served as a National Lawyers Guild credentialed international observer for elections in Venezuela, also in Honduras and El Salvador. She just was at the National Lawyers Guild conference last week and met with their international committee, where she was helping to lead discussions on Venezuela. Susan Scott, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so on these sanctions, are they really, first of all, do you think that they're basically token sanctions, since they really don't go after the oil? But even if they are, do they meet international law?
Sanctions are a kind of a tricky thing. If you compare the sanctions that the U.S. has imposed against Cuba to the sanctions the UN imposed against Iraq, there are, in both cases, you have major, major humanitarian destruction that really violates international humanitarian law.
Mm-hmm.
The question of the sovereignty issue is another whole issue. So sanctions both impact states' sovereignty rights as well as international humanitarian law. And when sanctions are imposed by the UN or the OAS or some international body, then you kind of get around the sovereignty issue. But when the sanctions are imposed by a single state, what we call unilateral sanctions, that's a major violation of state sovereignty and is considered to be in violation of international law, even apart from the impact on humanity. So the sanctions that the U.S. is constantly imposing on a unilateral basis on a lot of countries really violate the charters of both the U.N. and, in the case of Venezuela, the OAS, the Article 19 and 20 that talk about fundamental rights and duties of states. They say that no state or group of states has the right to interfere directly or indirectly in the internal or external affairs of any other state. The foregoing principle prohibits not only armed forces, but also any other form of interference or attempted threat against the personality of the state or against its political, economic, and cultural elements.
Right.
And Article 20 says no state may use or encourage the use of coercive measures of an economic or political character in order to force the sovereign will of another state and obtain from it advantages of any kind. So it seems pretty straightforward that imposing sanctions unilaterally on another state that has the effect of violating one of those things, that's a violation of international law. If it also impacts the humanitarian conditions in the state, then that's another additional problem. And certainly the sanctions that have been imposed so far on Venezuela have a minimal impact on the people, because they're just, except for Nicolas Maduro, I seriously doubt if he has a lot of investments in the United States, or probably most of the other people who have been sanctioned probably aren't having, don't have a lot of investments that are impacted, although they may. And if they do, it violates due process to be just slapping a sanction without having any kind of opportunity for the other side to give their side of the story. But just the threat of sanctions against oil exporting or importing. One of the other things that's being floated is that the U.S. would not send light oil to Venezuela, and Venezuela needs light oil to mix in with its crude oil in order to export to other countries. So that would have a also devastating impact on the Venezuelan economy, which is, it gets like 95% of its dollars from the sale of oil.
Right. And it seems from what you're saying, I mean, between the OAS, the UN, or any other international body, that even though these sanctions are highly questionable and do break, you know, some international laws, that there doesn't seem to be anything anybody can do about it. I mean, are there any entities that are challenging any of this?
There are, you know, there's constantly resolutions being passed. In the OAS right now, it's problematic because the Secretary General of the OAS is a huge detractor of Nicolas Maduro.
Yeah.
And has been really personally attacking him for many years, really, now. And trying to, and of course the U.S. is right behind him, and they've been trying to basically expel Venezuela from the OAS. And so far, there's been enough members, even with this new resurgence of right-wing elements in various countries that used to be far more to the left, there and have broken with Maduro. There still are enough countries in Latin America so that they're in the Americas. So that he has not been successful.
Yeah, I wanted to say in the Americas, because the Caribbean region have actually played a critical role in stopping, you know, the OAS from moving against Venezuela in the way that they wanted to do. And I know a lot of people, they talk about the Americas as Latin America and Central America, and they really forget about those of us. I'm from Barbados. Those of us from the Caribbean region who were really played an important role here. So,
right. But actually, the even the Obama administration was really trying to turn that around, and Joe Biden made numerous trips down to the Caribbean trying to wean them off the Petrosur dollar, you know, and trying to get them away from their support of Venezuela. But so far, you know, mostly unsuccessfully.
That's
really quite amazing.
That's right. Well, we'll have to see how all of this goes. By the way, just quickly, a final comment from you. What was the support like at the National Lawyers Guild conference around this issue?
The Guild has a history from 2006 of going down to Venezuela. And so there are probably 180 to 100 people from the Guild, lawyers from the Guild and law students, who have gone down first for a really big delegation that we did in 2006, and then every year after, including three delegations the year when Chavez died and Maduro was elected, which was a very contentious year. We sent election delegations, and people wrote reports. The reports are on our website. It's kind of hard to find, but it's basically, if you go to nlg.org and look around for international committee and reports, you can find numerous reports that we made on this just amazing electoral system that they have. And so there are a lot of people who are really, really upset with what's going on there, not just because of, you know, the misery of the people and the attacks on the Bolivarian project that we really have come to really, really respect and we saw it at this real heyday. We also are really concerned with the amount of repression that's going on basically against the people who have been Chavistas for years but are critical of this Constituent Assembly process. So we wanted to, rather than have, you know, just completely a total support for the Maduro government, we wanted to express our support for the Bolivarian project, but also find out more what was behind this concept of the Constituent Assembly.
Right.
So we did a conversation that was really useful, and a lot of people attended, and I think I'm going to be doing a report on it.
Oh, very good. I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. We are out of time. Susan Scott, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We are now going to go to our weekly Earth Watch. And to open up our Earth Watch, we're going to go to a short clip from Free Speech Radio News. Now, this is Bolivia. According to Free Speech Radio News, they've been in the midst of a major water crisis for some time now. And residents of the city of La Paz were under strict rationing rules. And President Evo Morales has gone with a project that is highly controversial. Let's go now to a clip from Free Speech Radio News.
The Bolivian government has revived a long-dormant plan to turn the Amazon region into an energy hub. The plan calls for the construction of two large hydroelectric dams on the Beni River and infrastructure to export the power generated to neighboring countries. President Evo Morales estimates the project would cost around $6 billion and, once operational, would bring in more than $1 billion a year. But indigenous communities in the region of the planned project say they are unwilling to pay the human cost of the so-called megadams. They also warn the environmental impact would be staggering due to the role of water cycles in the Amazon region's complex ecosystem. Sara La Paz is an expert in protected natural reserves.
The Amazon is a delicate ecoregion that greatly depends on its balance of water, on the course of its rivers, and on the places where that water pools. These are areas within the National System of Protected Areas. These are also areas protected by their own indigenous communities, because those communities depend on the well-being and balance of the ecosystems within those territories.
According to a leaked environmental impact assessment, the two dams will flood an area larger than the city of La Paz, affecting around 4,000 people in 17 communities within and near the flood zone. Indigenous Timanes, Tacanas, Mosetenes, and Uchupiamonas wrongly reject the project, saying it never went through the formal consultation required by the country's constitution and international accords.
All righty, and there you heard a short piece from Free Speech Radio News. But I'd like to welcome Pablo Salón, the director of Fundación Salón and former executive director of Focus on the Global South, and also a former Bolivian ambassador to the United Nations. Pablo, welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to all your audience and to discuss this very important issue.
Right. Now, what do you see as the problem? I mean, there is a water crisis, at least this is what we're being told. Glaciers are melting at an alarming rate. The country's second largest lake has dried up. But nevertheless, with this, people are protesting this mega dam, these mega dams that are supposed to help with these problems. Pablo.
Well, in Bolivia, we have had a very strong drought. At the end of last year, here in La Paz, there were more than 100 neighborhoods that could only have water every 2 days, 8 hours. Mm. We still have a drought in the south part of the country, in the city of Potosí. And it seems that this year we will suffer in many places the same situation. And drought means that we also now have a lot of forest fires because it's now, even though it's winter, it's very dry and warm, so it's very problematic.
Right.
Now, the issue of the mega dams that you are asking for, they are the mega dams of Bala and Chepete, they are in the middle of the Amazon. So if you build the dam of Chepete, you will have a new lake that will be the third biggest lake of Bolivia because it's going to flood around 650 square kilometers. To give you an idea, the entire city of La Paz is only 150 square kilometers. So it's going to be four times more than the city of La Paz. But this dam it's going to flood more than 100,000 hectares of forest. And it's not for water for the city. It's water to generate electricity to export to Brazil. So there is a very strong resistance from indigenous people in the area because they are saying that this mega dam project is going to harm their territory because they live there, and second, it's going to harm Mother Earth and nature. Also now in Bolivia, the most biggest conflict that you have today is that the government has approved a law to build a road through a national park that is called Pitneys. This is a conflict that comes from the year 2011. And now you have in Bolivia a lot of protests of indigenous people and people in urban areas saying, we cannot promote projects that deforest because if there is less trees, there is less humidity in the air, and therefore you have more dryness and more droughts. So instead of promoting this kind of projects that are harming our forest, we should be promoting a different kind of project that live with the forest and don't destroy the forest.
Yeah, and we have about a minute and a half left, but I'm sure, you know, many people may be surprised to hear that you are actually being targeted by the government for criticizing this particular project. And of course, Bolivia is known to have put forward the document about the rights of Mother Earth. You served as the UN ambassador in Bolivia. Just tell us, before we have to end up here briefly, about that.
Yes, it is absolutely true, because what I'm saying to the government is that we have to be coherent.
Yeah.
What we say at international level, we have to practice inside Bolivia. So we cannot violate the rights of Mother Earth by destroying forests that really don't need to be destroyed. We have to be preserving them.
Yeah.
So the government has targeted me. And here we are in a conflict that now it's not in relation to me. It's in relation to many indigenous groups that are preparing and doing mobilizations because they want to defend the forests of the Pitneys that is being targeted by this road.
Right, right. Well, Pablo, we Salon, we wish you safety and good luck with all of this. And, you know, concerning me, when you look at the two dams will flood an area, as you say, larger than the entire city of La Paz, affecting thousands of people in 17 communities within or near the flood zone. So we're going to keep our eye on this. And Pablo, we hope that you will join us again and give us an update as to how this campaign against these mega dams are coming along. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and we also want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project, who partner with us for our weekly Earth Watch. We're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, our intern Sherelle Withers, our assistant producer Stephanie Case, and our engineer Kiana Williams. And if you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230. Or go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.